This is Ozarks at Large for Tuesday, November 22nd, 2011. I'm Kyle Kellums.
And I'm Antoinette Grajeda. In just a moment on Ozarks, Brooke Hauser talks to Kyle about her book, The New Kids, that chronicles a year at a high school in Brooklyn where the entire student body is made up of immigrants. And later on Arkansongs, Iris Dement is the subject.
Support for Ozarks at Large and KUAF is provided by Crystal Bridges Museum of American Art, celebrating the American spirit by uniting the power of art with the beauty of nature. Open in Bentonville, 11 a.m. daily, except Tuesdays. Free tickets are available online at crystalbridges.org. This is Ozarks at Large. If you were ever a new kid at school, it's likely you can still recall the challenges associated with trying to figure out and fit in at the new school. For some new students, the challenges include figuring out a second language, immigration laws, or simply how to get to the school building. International High School at Prospect Heights in Brooklyn has a student body coping with many of those issues. The students are recent immigrants learning English. Brooke Hauser spent a year at the school following the students, and she's written about it in the book The New Kids, Big Dreams and Brave Journeys at a High School for Immigrant Teens. Brooke Hauser is with me on the phone. Brooke, welcome to Ozarks at Large.
Thanks for having me, Kyle.
How did you find out about this school?
I had a friend who was working at the International Rescue Committee, which is an agency that resettles refugees across the country. And he and his girlfriend actually told me about a volunteer opportunity where you could work with recent refugee youth and help them with writing and various activities at school. So at first I was really interested in a different international high school and working there as a volunteer, but the more I learned about this network of international high schools called the International's Network for Public Schools, the more interested I became in writing about the kids instead of just volunteering to tutor them.
How do you manage to get yourself embedded in a school, any school, for a year and earn the trust not just of teenagers but of the people who are trying to teach them?
That's a really good question. And what happened is I started by writing an article about the high school. This is a high school where students come from more than 45 different countries and speak more than 28 different languages. And I was just so intrigued by the idea of the entire world being under one roof in this high school. And so I thought, what would be a good angle for an article? And it occurred to me that all of these kids are, you know, coming from around the world, but they're all learning what exactly it means to be American through high school. So I thought, what are things that are quintessentially American and quintessentially high school? And prom came to mind. So I wrote an article about the students putting on their first ever prom. Many of the kids had never heard of prom before. They had no idea what it was, which made the planning of it very difficult. And that was an article. It was called This Strange Thing Called Prom. It appeared in the New York Times. And in the end, the prom was unlike any other. The most popular girl was a nomadic yak herder from Tibet. And it was just such a blast and all in all a pretty positive article. So I used the article as leverage with the school principal when I came back the following year and asked her if I could spend a year at the school to write the book.
What I love, and as you mentioned, the whole world under this roof.
Yeah.
And as you read The New Kids, Big Dreams and Brave Journeys at a High School for Immigrant Teens, you realize as a reader how little you do know about the rest of the world. Just these small details. There is a student named Mohammed from Sierra Leone, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
And he finds out at one point how old he is.
Right.
And it's because there are no birthdays. He mentions there's not even the words happy birthday in his native language.
Right. That was very surprising to me. I didn't know that either. Mohammed comes from, you know, a very poor and small rural village in Sierra Leone, and he speaks a few languages, including English now, but at the time when he was a kid growing up in Sierra Leone, he spoke Creole, which is like a broken English dialect of Sierra Leone, and he spoke Fula, which is also called Fulani, and it's a West African language. And he told me that in Fula there was no words. There were no words for happy birthday, and in fact, he never celebrated his birthday until he came to America. So therefore, he actually was very confused about his age And he found, I was with him on the day that he found out he was actually a whole year older than he thought he was.
Yeah, he finds out that since he was born in 1992, he's actually 17.
Yeah.
And he's quite happy about that.
Yeah, it was mind-blowing, and we all joked that he really needed to, watch the movie Sweet 16 because he basically missed out on his 16th birthday. And then there was another boy from Tibet who had a clearer idea of how old he was, but in Tibet, the way they measured birthdays there was his grandmother just recalled the day he was born based on the height of the weeds that year and certain other things that had to do with the climate and the growth, season in Tibet that helped her all place the day of his birthday because, they didn't use a typical calendar where they marked the dates, of birthdays when he grew up. So it was a few students had this issue.
One of the most poignant figures for me, and I have a reader's vocabulary on her name, Cheet Soo.
Yeah, that's good.
Oh, wow. She was from Burma.
Uh-huh.
And she's the only student in the entire school that knows her language.
Right.
How isolating that must feel at times.
Mm-hmm. And also isolating because, she was one of the kids who I chose to focus on from the very, very beginning. I was looking, all of the kids are quote-unquote new kids because they're all new to the country. But Cheet Soo was a new kid because she had just come from Burma or Myanmar, several weeks before school started. And not only was she new to the school, but she was actually late. She came in a few days late. So she really missed out on orientation when the teachers point out to the kids where the cafeteria is and where their classrooms are. And she came in, the only student, the only person in the entire school who spoke her language, Burmese. And so the teachers really had their work cut out for them. They didn't have many records or transcripts from her because she didn't come from a traditional schooling background. She had just come from a refugee camp in Thailand. She spoke only a few words of English, so they really from the beginning had to assess just how much English does she speak, can she write, can she read, can she do basic math. And once they assessed those things, and the answer was yes, she could read, write, and do basic math, then they could begin to, think about how best to acculturate her into this classroom of other freshmen and sophomores that she was in.
I'm talking with Brooke Hauser. She's the author of The New Kids, Big Dreams and Brave Journeys at a High School for Immigrant Teens. It's a high school in Brooklyn that is populated by students from dozens of countries. You not only follow some of the students through the year, you also make sure that we get to know the faculty and staff. And what teaching, no one in the right mind claims that teaching is an easy job. At this one, there are so many other challenges or different sorts of circumstances from what we would think of a normal high school.
Absolutely. I think this school and the model that it follows works so well because they have a program called advisory. Now, teachers and other staff members, in addition to their normal schedules are also advisors, which means they basically look after the welfare of a group of students for the entire year. And, depending on the advisor, the role can really change. An advisor can be an academic representative. If a student is failing school, they can talk to the kid's other teachers and try to figure out how best to help that student. But other times, an advisor might almost be more like a guardian angel. I've seen advisors do everything from a student was kicked out of her father's apartment during her first week in the United States, and her advisor tried helping her find a place to live, even called homeless shelters on her behalf. Other students, there have been Muslim girls from strict backgrounds, girls who really wanted to go to the prom, and their more conservative fathers wouldn't let them. And I've seen an advisor step in and try and negotiate with the father you know, please let your daughter go to prom. Everything will be okay. There are going to be teachers there and chaperones there. And, you know, the kids have to deal with all sorts of problems that students at my high school never had to deal with. I knew several kids who were either married or about to be married, several students who already had children, several students who weren't sure if they were going to stay in this country or go back to their native country. Students who are undocumented, advisors help with applications for visas, finding jobs, everything. I mean, everything you could possibly imagine.
How, as a writer, did you ever have to struggle to keep objectivity? I mean, here are people with amazing stories, a young man who spent 24 hours in a suitcase on his way to the U.S. Did you ever find yourself, in your mind, becoming too emotionally attached to the people you were observing?
I was always aware of that and how that could happen. And, you know, the thing with these kids is that they're most of the kids who I know and who I've written about are extremely charming, lovable. I mean, you really root for them. But at the same time, as you point out, it's important to keep a journalistic distance. So really what I tried to do was, you know, if I was feeling that a certain student was really working their charm on me, I would try and take a break from that student for a few weeks and let the magic wear off a little bit and really hunker down and think as objectively as possible about this kid, what he had told me, you know, go over the details of his story. And I really tried to not rely on the students alone. I also interviewed and cross-checked and fact-checked information with teachers and other staff, social workers, parents, siblings. You know, I just felt it was important all along to verify the students' stories because, you know, all human memory is flawed. But especially, I think, teenagers who are coming here from another country and telling their stories in a new language, English. Mm. I think it's very important to be careful about retelling those stories and try to make sure that you have everything as accurate as you can.
You do such a wonderful job of giving us visual images of these days at school. And one of the best is during the inauguration of President Obama and the chaos and excitement and, for some people, confusion of what's happening.
Yeah. The inauguration of Obama and the election of Obama was very interesting to me because in America and to Americans, native-born Americans, I think we all understood the significance of our country electing its first black president. We understood that significance very deeply and very innately. And these students, there were many, many students coming from West Africa and Haiti. And, you know, these kids, they've seen black men as leaders before. They've seen black women as leaders. And so I think that, you know, it took a while for them to realize why exactly this was so monumental for our country. In that sense, America, you know, has been a little behind the curve. And so, you know, they learned during that time more about America's civil rights history, more about the tensions and frictions that have existed really always, you know, in this country. And once they got that background, I think they really saw why it was so important that Obama was elected. But they needed a little crash course on American history in order to understand that.
This was the seniors, the year that you were following them at the school would have been the class of 2009.
Right.
Graduating class of slightly more than 80. Have you been able to keep up with those graduating seniors?
I think it's slightly more than 60. I'm not
okay.
Sure now. But yes, absolutely, I have kept up with many of the kids. First of all, we're all on Facebook. So that's funny, and I have a very interesting news feed on Facebook, you could say. And, you know, I see them in person, too. I've had a few events for the book, a book party. I'm doing a talk at a museum here in New York this week, and students have been coming out to some of the events for the book. And then, of course, I was invited to give the commencement speech at their graduation last year, a different graduating class, the class of 2011. But that was really great, and I got to see a lot of familiar faces in the crowd. So we've definitely kept in touch.
I imagine, much as if you move to a new place for a year or, you know, work transfers you someplace, that year changes your life. I'm sure that this year at this school changed you, not just provided you with an opportunity to write about it in a book, but it had to change you a little bit.
It did. I think it just made me, in some ways, it made me more patriotic. I just, I feel that, I feel very lucky to have been born in this country after I've seen some of the struggles that the students have had to go through, the perilous journeys that they've had to endure in order to get to this country, and I see how badly they want to be here. And, you know, 15% of the senior class the year I was there was undocumented. That means that they really struggle with what's going to happen next. In this country, we give students a free public education from kindergarten up until the 12th grade, but once they graduate high school, the kids who don't have their papers really, in most places, are not eligible for financial aid. They can get a private scholarship, but that's very, very difficult and rare to get. So I think for me, how it changed me, I would say I just really stopped taking for granted some of the privileges that I've had in my life. And I felt very lucky to have my family here, to have my home here. You know, it's come more easily for me than it has for some of these kids.
I love how you start the book, because although this is a very different high school from, say, the one I went to in the 70s and 80s, where the most exotic person was an Episcopalian, but although this is a very different high school than the one that most of us went to, you do, in the first paragraph, show that it is also somewhat similar over time and geography. You write that everybody has the outfit, and that's capitalized, the outfit. The outfit they bought for America. The students who have lived in the country for longer have learned how to blend in better, disappearing in brand-name sneakers and low-riding jeans. But each September, on the first day of school, the new kids are easy to spot. That feeling is universal, I think, no matter where you've come from or where that new school is.
Absolutely. I mean, I used to go back to school outfit shopping every year. And, you know, the difference is my mom would take me to the mall and I'd get a whole bunch of new outfits for September. But a lot of these students, they've been saving up for one very special outfit. And, you know, the students, their financial, ethnic, racial, religious backgrounds, they really range. But the majority of the students are poor. And, you know, I wrote about one kid coming here, and he wore a pair of blue jeans that his uncle had hand sewn for him to make them look like American blue jeans. That probably took a lot of time and a lot of labor. And there are other kids who show up wearing what people might describe as church clothes. You know, some of the Haitian kids, they just look so proper, and they don't really blend in to the rest of the kids who, you know, their pants are on the ground, basically. Mm-hmm. And then one year I was there, a different year, I just came back for a few days. There was a boy who wore a shirt that, if you saw it from far away, it said Gap, like a Gap logo. But then you came closer and you saw that it stood for God Answers Prayers. Mm. And, you know, they some of the kids, I think, get a little teased for some of the first day of school outfits that they choose to wear. But eventually their style really changes the longer they stay in the country and kind of observe what other American-born kids are wearing.
The name of the book is The New Kids, Big Dreams and Brave Journeys at a High School for Immigrant Teens. Brooke Hauser, congratulations on a wonderful first book, and thank you so much for your time.
Thank you for the thoughtful interview. I appreciate it, Kyle.
Later on Ozarks, what television shows do the highest income American viewers like? What three things do women over 50 apparently like on TV more than anything else? And why do people under 30 not even know NBC exists? A new breakdown of American viewing habits by New York Magazine's website Culture Vulture is discussed by our own pop culture guide, Wayne Bell. Plus, a holiday gift bazaar featuring local artists and their wares. The Northwest Arkansas Community Creative Center's Holiday Art Bazaar is up next on Ozarks.
Earth, sky.
People are fascinated by sharks, but scientists still have a lot to learn about them. That's according to Washington Post science reporter Juliet Eilprin, whose new book on sharks is called Demon Fish. The book was released in June 2011. Here she is.
What's happened is there have been advances in technology, particularly in terms of tracking things like satellite tagging, radio transmission, that have allowed scientists to get a better sense of all sorts of shark behavior.
Eilprin said that, for example, scientists studying great white sharks off the U.S. Pacific coast have been able to identify with precision how many sharks are living there and their pattern of migration to the Hawaiian Islands.
What we've learned is that they have as regular migration patterns as wildebeest in Africa that are traveling on land. They're much more directed than we realized before. In addition, we simply had no idea how many whites are out there.
Sharks have a built-in compass called electroreception that allows them to migrate long distances and to navigate the underwater highways of Earth's oceans.
For example, hammerheads go out at night on certain patterns, find food, and then find their way back home, and that they shift where they go when magnetic patterns of the Earth shift.
Earth Sky is a clear voice for science.
We're at earthsky.org.
Saturday and Sunday, December 3rd and 4th, the Northwest Arkansas Community Creative Center will host its fourth annual Holiday Art Bazaar at the Nadine Baum Studios in downtown Fayetteville. Earlier this month, Susan Hutchcroft, the executive director of the Community Creative Center, and Barbara Putman, a board member, came to KUAF to give us some highlights of the center and the upcoming bazaar. Susan says the core mission is to bring people into the studios at the center to see what their hands and minds can create.
Basically, what our motto is it's all about losing yourself, forgetting about what's happening during the day, and just enjoying creating.
That's my first experience with the Creative Center. Is I took a class, and it was, what do you call that, free form? It wasn't the pottery on the
Hand
building. That's what I took. I took a hand building class, and it was delightful. You lose yourself. You're just focused on what you're doing, and you can think about things or not think about things, and you know, sometimes I would get tense because it's not creative enough, or you know, and then, but the other students and the artists there and the teachers were just so, you know, wonderfully supportive, and my next class is the wheel class, and you know, we have about, how many do we have? 12?
14
wheels where students will come in and put a glob of clay down, and magically, with, you know, help from the artists, mm-hmm. will create some wonderful vase or bowl or some other piece of art.
We've talked about clay, but there are all sorts of different artistic endeavors you can enroll in.
Yes, we have four studios. We have a studio that is mainly used for easel work, which would be watercolors, painting, acrylics. We have a live model that comes in every Friday. Sometimes it's used during our summer camps for, you know, anything from clay to multimedia. We have another studio that is basically everything goes on in there. It's full of supplies. It's very well equipped. We have large tables, so it's basically for working down on a flat surface. And then we have a mosaic studio that we opened up last year.
Yeah, don't you break things sometimes to make a mosaic?
Oh, absolutely.
Okay.
We have the cutest little hammers for the kids. They
break
love
tiles and
oh,
what?
Oh, yes, yes. And it's very well equipped. I think one of our biggest problems we have at the center is there's so many choices. We're trying to delight everybody's fancy, and sometimes it can be overwhelming. The same thing with the clay studio. We have so many glazes they can choose from. And all our supplies are provided with the cost of the class, so it's pretty cool.
First weekend in December, the Art Bazaar.
Yes.
Now, this is art made by?
It's all local artists. It has to be made by them, produced by them. We have a lot of the artists that take classes at the studio are down there selling too. So that's it's a lot of unique pieces.
Really wonderfully unique. I worked my first Holiday Bazaar last year, and the artists are so excited. And that one woman, she just kept coming up and buying things. She was working with her sister. Her sister was an artist selling, but she was walking around buying things. And she goes, I can't show my sister anymore because she'll make fun of me. But it was just a wonderful experience. And what I found is that many board members, I think every board member except me, is an artist who creates. Mm. And so, so I always get to see the wonderful things they're working on.
I'm not an artist. I've never understood. Obviously, you have to feed and pay the rent, so I get this. But how hard it must be if you've created something that you really take pride in, and then you sell it. I think I'd be a horrible artist because I think I'd want to keep everything I made.
Well, I have a few things okay. I don't let go. But, you know, once you make it, before you finish it, you're kind of on to something else. Hmm. You know, this has inspired you to move on to something else. So unless it has some personal attachment to, you're excited to work on something else, and you're even more pleased to get some money in your pocket
sure.
for it so you can work on. So,
well, and the pleasure in knowing that somebody else likes it mm-hmm. enough mm-hmm. to want it in their home or give it as a gift. Any idea how many artists will participate in the bazaar?
Well, this year we're actually advertising for artists, mm-hmm. so it'll be interesting to see how many we have. But usually we have about 6 or 7 potters, and then we'll have equally that amount of, like, mixed with jewelry, painting, handmade gloves.
Hmm. Paper artists.
Paper artists.
Yeah.
Sometimes we've had people who make candles. Mm-hmm. It can be an assortment of different things as long as it's made locally.
And it is set up like a bazaar. I mean, you can walk from mm-hmm. artist to artist and see what she or he
You
has.
Can, and we take credit cards, cash, checks, so that makes it easier. The biggest problem we have there is getting people through the checkout mm-hmm. line fast enough, which is great. It's a good problem.
It's Saturday morning from 10 until 4. That's mm-hmm. the 3rd of December. And then the next day, Sunday the 4th, mm-hmm. from noon until 4.
Mm-hmm. Yes. We usually have it just one day. This year we're going to open it up for 2 days and see how that goes.
What I love about it is really the opportunity to find gifts, holiday mm-hmm. gifts. That is the best. And you don't really think about it until you see people coming and they just have a big box of things, and it's like I've just taken care of my holiday shopping, and they're unique. And
well, that's it. You know that it's not this thing from the store. That
it's not another sweater,
right?
Yeah, or a tie or something like that. Yeah,
and there's no chance somebody else has gotten that same
right,
gift.
Right. That is to me the most, and it's you double dip almost. It's not only are you giving something that you hope they will enjoy, but also you're giving something to the artists and you know, supporting this great organization, which we are very fortunate to have some good support. So,
people want to know more about either the Art Bazaar or classes or anything about the center, they can go to the website.
Absolutely.
And that is?
www.nwaccc.org.
The bazaar Saturday, December 3rd from 10 until 4, and then the next day, Sunday, noon until 4. Thank you both very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Susan Hutchcroft is the executive director of the Northwest Arkansas Community Creative Center, and Barbara Putman is a member of the center's board of directors. They visited the Anthony and Susan Hoy new studio earlier this month. This is Ozarks at Large. It's Tuesday, November 22nd, 2011. This is Ozarks at Large. Joining us now is Becca Bacon-Martin, features editor for Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
And if you're not cooking by now, look up and look at what day it is.
Oh, I know. Oh, yes. We begin planning like weeks prior to the actual holiday in my house.
We're actually doing some of the cooking at my house this year
to
take to Granny's. It's kind of terrifying.
It'll
Larry's
be okay.
mostly in charge of it. Well, it should be okay.
It'll be okay.
Tonight, Country Year Way, which happens every week in Springdale at the Senior Center, is celebrating their 10th anniversary.
Okay.
They do a little jamming. They have musicians that play regularly. You can come and dance a little. Could be a lot of fun. Starts at 7 o'clock, and you can find out more at 236-0373. Or you can make your way to the Arkansas Best Performing Arts Center in Fort Smith for a lifetime of jazz with the UAFS Jazz Band and the Jazz Cats. That happens at 7:30, and tickets are $6.
All right. Well, thank you, Becca.
Mm-hmm.
Becca Bacon-Martin is features editor for Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
From Little Rock, I'm Stephen Cook with Arkansongs. Iris Dement is from rural Paragould in northeast Arkansas and became a country and folk sensation in the 1990s. Born January 5, 1961, she grew up in a musical and religious family and was the youngest of 14 children. Gospel music was the order of the day in her Pentecostal household. Despite her Arkansas origins, Dement said she didn't hear much folk or country music until after the family moved to Cypress, California.
Everybody is wondering what and where they all came from. Everybody is worrying about where they're going to go when the whole thing's done.
Iris Dement attended college in Kansas City and then relocated to Nashville, Tennessee in the late 1980s to become a performer. By the early 1990s, she was an acclaimed singer-songwriter with a hot record on a major label when Warner Brothers re-released her Rounder Records debut called Infamous Angel. The album's opener, Let the Mystery Be, heard here, has been covered by several artists, including 1990s alternative rock band 10,000 Maniacs and blues guitarist Alice Stewart.
She grew up plain and simple in a farming town. Her daddy played the fiddle and used to do the calling when they had hold down.
Jerry Douglas, Emmylou Harris, and Roy Husky Jr. appear on Infamous Angel. With songs like Mama's Opry heard here, Iris Dement's debut album is largely a celebration of her Arkansas roots and family. Dement's mother, Flora Mae Dement, even gets a lead vocal turn on Infamous Angel's closer called Higher Ground.
I'm pressing on the upward way, new heights I'm gaining every day.
The Arkansasier followed up Infamous Angel less than a year later with an album in spring of 1994 called My Life. It too seemed to harken back to her earliest days. It also continued her rise, being nominated for a Grammy for Best Contemporary Folk Album. 2 years then passed before Iris Dement's next record, The Way I Should, which explored broader lyrical as well as musical themes. The song Our Town from Infamous Angel closed out the series finale of the Emmy-winning TV show Northern Exposure in 1995.
Go on now and say goodbye to our town, to our town. Can't you see the sun setting down on our town, on our town? Good night.
Also through the 1990s, Iris Dement sang harmony or duets with artists such as Emmylou Harris, Tom Paxton, Nancy Griffith, Randy Scruggs, and Steve Earle. Her most frequent and perhaps incongruous duet partner has been John Prine. In 1999, Iris Dement's debut, Infamous Angel, was named one of Rolling Stone magazine's essential recordings of the 1990s, solidifying her ubiquity in the decade. 8 years passed, however, before her fourth album, Lifeline. She could be heard singing in the closing credits of the 2010 movie remake of Arkansasier Charles Portis' novel, True Grit, and appeared in the 2000 movie Songcatcher. But comparatively speaking, the 21st century has been quiet for Greene County's Iris Dement, folk music's veritable it girl of the 1990s. Here in its entirety is Arkansasier Iris Dement of Paragould in Greene County in northeast Arkansas with Let the Mystery Be from her early 90s debut album, Infamous Angel.
Everybody is wondering what and where they all came from. Everybody is worrying about where they're gonna go when the whole thing's done. Let the mystery be. Some say once gone, you're gone forever. And some say you're gonna come back. Some say you rest in the
out, yes, let the mystery be. Everybody is wondering what and where they all came from. Everybody is worrying about where they're gonna go.
Iris DeMint of Greene County in Northeast Arkansas with Let the Mystery Be from her early 1990s debut album, Infamous Angel. It's another song of Arkansas. From Little Rock, I'm Stephen Cook with Arkansongs.
Arkansongs is a production of FM 89 and Experiment Station Studios. Associate producer of Arkansongs is Keith Merks. For more information, visit arkansongs.org. Arkansongs, since 1999.
This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Kellums. With me is Wayne Bell. He writes the column Culture Club for FayettevilleFlyer.com. Welcome back.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
As we approach Thanksgiving, there is a new list on the website that's Culture Vulture, which covers popular culture, and it gives certain networks on television plenty to be thankful for and others
something to think about.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, it's real interesting because this is the time of the year in November and then premiere and finale and then February, those four periods of the year when Nielsen ratings are really looked at heavily. And so we know that the number one show on television is, you know, Dancing with the Stars, mm-hmm. or American Idol in the spring. What we don't know, which is what Culture Vulture, which is a segment of New York Magazine, has recently done, is looked at different profiles, different segments of society, and looked at what we actually watch on television, which I think is really kind of fascinating. You know, what minorities watch, or what men watch versus women, or teens versus adults, income bracket. And we see that, you know, amongst the demographics that spend a lot of money or have expendable money, the top 10 shows aren't necessarily the same as, you know, just the general top 10. So it's a really fascinating thing to look at when you start looking at the Nielsen numbers and comparing them to the, you know, census data and things like that.
So this list, for example, figured out what households with the highest median income are watching.
Yeah, which doesn't really surprise me that much. The highest watch show with a high median income of somewhere between $83,000 and $100,000 is Modern Family.
Now, Modern Family does very well in the ratings anyway, and it's won many Emmys, mm-hmm. so that it's not like this is some unknown show.
No, and if you watch Modern Family, although it's somewhat subtle at times, I mean, they're very affluent. So, and their problems are, although, I mean, they do a very good job of having a cross, you know, sector of problems. But, and two of the people that are on there, Well, three of them, actually.
Are stay-at-home parents.
Yeah, mm-hmm. That's really interesting. I've never thought about that, that one out of each of the couples is – and that's a – that's not really realistic. But anyway, we do find that people who make between $85,000 and $100,000 a year tend to watch that. They also tend to watch The Office, mm-hmm. Parenthood, and Parks and Recreation. And those three shows, with the exception of maybe The Office, Parks and Rec and Parenthood have really stumbled, and they're not really holding NBC up.
But if you can go to advertisers and say, mm-hmm. Parenthood, this drama that's on Tuesday nights, which is dying in the ratings, but the people who do watch have expendable income, that's how you can stay on the air.
Right. It's funny, though, because if you start looking at the statistics, NBC has really got something to worry about here, because other than, those with expendable income, which is a smaller group than it mm-hmm. once was, and like teen boys and stuff who watch The Office, for the most part.
And throw out Sunday Night Football. That's an outlier.
Right.
But their scripted shows.
Yeah.
Hardly anyone under 30 is watching.
The shows that people under 30 are watching, like Family Guy or Glee or New Girl, none of that stuff is on
NBC,
which is really interesting, given that NBC there for a while was, the hip and newish network with cutting edge stuff like ER and Friends, and it's
or
not
even
that anymore.
Across the board, hits everyone, it seemed, watch Cosby or Cheers.
Well, yeah, even
or Friends.
Well, even going back, even Golden Girls had cross demographic.
Right.
Golden Girls is still, if you ever look at the stats of stuff that's watched in dorms, it's always up there. Among all people, it's really strange how that show is really and that was an NBC property, and they just don't have anything right now. Some other things that are really interesting that I saw were that The Good Wife, for instance, that does really well at the Emmys and does pretty well on the ratings and everything. You'd think that their core demographic would be, the 18 to 35 year old women, because Juliana Margulies is, real appealing and she's been around for a while. But the truth is, it's actually older women and surprisingly men. Of the 18 to 35 year olds, only about 1.6 rating share points, which is very small, actually falls with women. So it's actually men in the older demographic that watch that show and not the target female demographic. Some other things regarding age, that we all know is that people, women over 50, all love the same thing, apparently, which is Dancing with the Stars, NCIS, and anything with Tom Selleck.
Those do great with women 50
yeah,
plus.
I don't get it. They do really well.
I think the big picture you get from this, and this is no surprise, but this even makes it more substantial than I thought, is that with all these channels, we don't have a shared experience with television anymore.
No.
You can have something that is incredibly popular with a demographic. I'm thinking of shows that are on the CW that involve witches or vampires
mm-hmm.
that are hugely popular with adolescents and young teens that you and I have never heard of.
Right.
That was not the case 25 years ago. You may
right.
not watch it, but you knew it existed.
Well, the classic example that I go back to over and over was Friends, where everybody was watching Friends.
Mm-hmm.
And that's simply not the case anymore. You can have, Mad Men is a four-time reigning Emmy champ. And Modern Family, they've made ground in ratings, but things like Mad Men and some of these other shows that do really well, with award show bait, they still, if they were on network television, they would be canceled in a heartbeat.
I wonder, I guess maybe a concern here is that people tend to associate, if possible, with people who have same values, political views, things like that. And it seems that your entertainment choices more and more tend to be that way. If you watch Mad Men, you know a lot of people, it seems, that watch Mad Men.
That's true.
If you watch Two and a Half Men or Glee, you tend to know a lot of your peers, the people you talk to, watch the same things. And I wonder if that's one more way that we're becoming more divided. I don't want to make too much out of television here,
But it's an interesting point, because when I come in and I talk to friends of mine, or we talk to other friends of ours, it seems everybody watches Mad Men. So you would think that the Mad Men would be soaring. And then when I go home for the holidays and we're talking about things we watch on TV, nobody really mentions Mad Men, but they certainly mention Two and a Half Men. And I, of course, have to excuse myself from that conversation because I haven't watched it. And that's when I realized that if you're not paying special attention to what's going on everywhere, then, you know, if you live only in your bubble with your circumstances, watching things that appeal to you with people around you that appeal to you, then you don't necessarily see. It's the same reason, not that it's television, but it's the same reason why I have trouble understanding how that Twilight movie can make $140 million this weekend. But I'm not in that circle.
Right.
Very few of my friends are in the circle that went to watch it.
Wayne, thanks a lot.
Thanks a lot.
Wayne Bell watches television. He also writes the column Culture Club for the FayettevilleFlyer.com. Tomorrow on Ozarks at Large, two of the country's leading First Amendment scholars discuss freedom of speech and more. Robert Post, the dean of Yale Law School, and Frederick Schauer, the former dean of Harvard's Kennedy School of Government, spoke on the University of Arkansas campus this fall as part of the Hartman-Hotz Lectures in Law and Liberal Arts. Before their presentation, they spent nearly a half hour talking about First Amendment-related topics inside an office at the University School of Law. We'll hear most of that conversation for the first time tomorrow on Ozarks at Large.
And Thanksgiving Day on Ozarks, Colin Bevan, the No Impact Man, discusses his book of that name and much more. We'll hear excerpts from his visit with Kyle at the Fayetteville Public Library from earlier this month on Thursday's Ozarks at Large.
And Friday on the show, three of our favorite musical duos we've invited in this year into the Furman Garner Performance Studio, including Black and Tan and Chase Missy. They'll discuss their music and they'll play for us once again. That's Friday on Ozarks at Large.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Tuesday. It's the 22nd of November, 2011. It's the birthday of André Gide, born in Paris, 1869. André Gide, who said, "Everything that needs to be said has already been said, but since no one was listening, everything must be said again." It's the birthday of the graphic artist and author and film director Marzan Satrapi, born in Rasht, Iran, 1969. Satrapi was a young girl during the Islamic Revolution of 1979. Her parents sent her off to Vienna to escape the resulting fundamentalism, and she wrote a graphic memoir about her experience in that time, Persepolis, the story of what it was like to be an Iranian girl, suddenly segregated from boys in school and forced to wear a hijab or headscarf. Published in 2000 in French, and then in 2007, Satrapi co-wrote and co-directed a movie adaptation of Persepolis, which got an Academy Award nomination for Best Animated Feature. Her recent autobiographical comics include Embroideries, the story of Satrapi's grandmother and aunts and the men they've loved, and Chicken with Plums, a chronicle of her great-uncle's last 8 days of life. It's the birthday of the novelist George Eliot, born Warwickshire, England, 1819, the pen name of Mary Ann Evans. We know her as the author of Adam Bede and Middlemarch. She was a famously unattractive woman. Henry James wrote that Eliot was magnificently ugly, deliciously hideous. She lived for 23 years with a man named George Lewis, though they never married. and she took his first name for her pseudonym, George Eliot. She was 40 years old when she published her first short story. She thought that choosing a pseudonym would cover her tracks. She was, after all, living unmarried with a married man. But her first novel, Adam Bede, was a huge success. People speculated about who George Eliot might be, and Marianne Evans was forced to reveal herself. Here's a poem for today by James Silas Rogers, Rutabagas, a love poem. Rutabagas were new to me when I first paired with Jean at Thanksgiving and Easter dinners, her grandpa Frank, her spinster cousin, mom, dad, and a tribe of handsome brothers dined in near silence at a great green table with fierce griffins underneath. I would wonder if their quiet was about secrets or something wrong, but now I think it was just how they gathered. Rutabagas were on the table. I had to ask Jean what they were. My first mouthful tasted like something in a gunny sack, nothing like a wine from which an epicure or would-be epicure might claim to read the soils in which the grapes were grown. She said she loved their dug-up texture, the hint of dirt that couldn't be baked away, how they left the tongue with a rumor of something underground and dark. Autumn vegetables suit her, I think, and none more than rutabagas, so reluctant to have left the ground. A poem by James Silas Rogers, Rutabagas, a love poem from his collection Sun Dogs, published by Parallel Press, and used by permission here in the Writer's Almanac, supported by Novo Nordisk since 1923, combining drug discovery with technology to turn science into diabetes treatments at novonordisk-us.com. And by CSX, transporting 2 billion pounds of goods to market by train and helping to move the economy forward. CSX, How Tomorrow Moves. Produced by our technical director, Thomas Schweitzker. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
And this is Ozarks at Large. A sports note, the number 14 University of Arkansas women's cross-country team competed yesterday at the national championships. They were ranked 14th going in, and they finished in 14th place. It's the 20th time that the Razorback women have had a top 15 national finish in program history.
The University of Arkansas Fort Smith Jazz Band and Jazz Cats will combine talents this evening for a lifetime of jazz, an evening of musical selections that will highlight new jazz tunes, as well as the standards made famous by Glenn Miller, Count Basie, and Duke Ellington. It takes place at the Arkansas Best Corporation Performing Arts Center. For cost or more information, 479-788-7300.
Speaking of music, the University of Arkansas Fulbright College Department of Music will feature the University of Arkansas Saxophone Chamber Orchestra, as well as other saxophone ensembles. That takes place Thursday night, December 1st at 7:30 p.m. That concert, held in the Stella Smith Boyle Concert Hall, that's in the Fine Arts Building on the UA campus. In case you don't remember, free parking available in the parking deck, which can be accessed from Stadium Drive. Admission to the concert is free. The public's invited. If you want more information about that December 1st concert, 575-4701.
KUAF is supported by Crystal Bridges Museum of American Art, celebrating the American spirit by uniting the power of art with the beauty of nature. Open in Bentonville, 11 a.m. daily, except Tuesdays. Free tickets are available online at crystalbridges.org.
Ozarks at Large is a production of KUAF. I'm Kyle Kellums.
And I'm Antoinette Grajeda. This is KUAF 91.3 FM, Fayetteville, Rogers, Fort Smith, Dallas.
Where is Dallas, Arkansas?
Just south of Mena.
Okay. Dallas is south of Mena, isn't it?
Yes.
All right. I'll be back tomorrow with a new edition of Ozarks at Noon. Have a great Tuesday.